or if you're the clampet, it's a stale.
Right, so you,
that
you
is
can,
the
there's a
most finely worded.
It is. Because everyone, you know, people are clamoring to make those essential oils at home.
I don't love making essential oils in a moonshine.
Right, still. Exactly.
Welcome to Bad Vultures Season 2, episode... Yeah, I didn't look it up.
Eight. Moron.
I'm so busy being right about predictions that I don't have time for that kind of thing.
For God's sake, have we now got an hour of you mithering about this?
Yes. So, more on that later on. But what? This is a different show. What are we going to talk about, El Gingero?
Well, we have had there've been various bits of news going on, but there's been one massively dominant one for the world of open source free software Linux desktop people, which is Canonical have made some pretty major announcements about how they're changing their the focus of what they're doing with Ubuntu and dropping some projects, refocusing on others. And so we've got something of a bumper special talking about it because it's a huge piece of news. We've got a lot of opinions about it.
Yeah. And that's pretty much, other than the news...
That's like the whole show.
That's all we're talking about. Show. So if you're not interested in Canonical and, you know, three news stories, then you should probably go and, you know, listen to the Linux Action Show. Oh, maybe not.
Oh, that was a...
Wow.
That was a joke. Come on, it's not too soon.
No, exactly. No. So yes. So, yeah, if you're genuinely not interested in Ubuntu, then I was going to say we'll go and join the Ubuntu Podcast's Telegram channel and chat to them instead. But... Yeah,
probably. Not interested in that.
You're not interested now either. So, yes. So,
I don't know. Go listen to Christina Warren's show. There
yes,
you go.
Rocky. We'll play the news first. So if you're not interested in Canonical, at least listen to the news, because I think the news segment was, as always, high quality and entertaining.
All right. Let's do it.
And now, Bad Voltage.
So it's the news. What's been going on in the fun lives of the tech world?
Ooh, fun
not
lives.
Much recently.
Well, to be clear, we're not talking about non-technology news because it just makes me want to jump out of a window or something. So, especially with today, we record this on Tuesday, right? So it's Tuesday the 18th of April, and they've just declared a snap general election in the UK, and I'm just not thinking about it. Tell me some amusing
right,
news
so
about crappy IoT devices.
Hang on. Before you go on, are you basically saying that it's terrible that, you know, the people are going to have an opportunity to elect their leaders fairly and justly?
There's a bit in... Have you seen Men in Black?
Yeah.
When I was a child, yeah.
there's a bit in it where Will Smith says, people are smart, and Tommy Lee Jones says, a person is smart. People are dumb, panicky animals, and you know it. And the thought has crossed my mind a couple of times in the last 6 months or so. And I fear this may be the absolute gold standard of that, right? We're not talking about it. Stop making me talk about the terrible politics.
Kind of sounds like we're
it's
talking
good.
About it, but yeah.
It is. Yeah, it is. Anyway, all right then, Langridge. Distract us with some interesting news.
Well, mine is not about terrible Internet of Things devices, but it is kind of amusing. You remember when Microsoft got busted by the US Department of Justice for unfairly using their OS monopoly to push their own apps, i.e. and things
also
like
when
that,
I was
right?
a child, yep. But yes, I remember.
Yes, yeah, well, welcome to the club, Google. Right? El Goog have just been raked over the coals by a Russian court for doing exactly precisely this same thing. And there's been a big settlement, and they've now said they can offer search engine choice so that this is on Android devices, right? They're going to offer search engine choice so you have to choose a search engine. It won't just bake in Google automatically. They won't require handset vendors to include the Google suite of apps and this kind of thing. Now, this is only in Russia. There is an EU case going on about precisely the same thing at the moment, so they'll be watching it relatively closely. But what I'm not sure about is whether this spills onto anything else, because Russia is weird. It's big enough that it's got sensible, large Russia-only players, Yandex in this particular example, right?
Right.
But it's not so.
I imagine where that when they play live.
Yeah, that's why it's important.
Spandex, sorry.
AC/DC. Brian Johnson tells a story that he pissed on Sputnik once. So,
what, the Dell laptops?
Not the Dell laptops.
More on that
so,
later.
Yeah, Russia have got Yandex, who are a big deal, and therefore see themselves as a rival to Google. But they're not as big a deal as it is in China, where they've got a completely separate ecosystem. Right. So I don't know whether this sort of settlement can really only take place in Russia, because everywhere else they go, we want there to be, you know, some other alternative search engine. They go, well, which alternative search engine? There aren't any.
Right.
Which alternative suite of apps? But it's still, I think, interesting that Google are tripping over the same things that Microsoft did back then, that bundling stuff with your operating system, people don't like it.
Right.
I have to say, I'm still just in two minds about this whole situation. On one hand, I get, you know, you don't want to have a market of gorillas who are forcing you into only their way of doing things. And I get that. But on the other hand, you know, if you go out and buy a bloody Android phone, it's like you're basically buying Google stuff, right? I mean, yes, it's an open source project, kind of. But on one hand, it's like, it's like going to Wendy's and, you know, and having the option of getting McDonald's fries. I mean, it's like you're in it for that stuff. I don't know. I'm conflicted.
Well, I mean, I think having the choice that there is a reasonable thing. I think in this particular case, unlike the Microsoft case, I cannot imagine that most people wouldn't still use Google because, to be frank, the search results are just better. So,
yeah,
Yeah, I'm more interested in the app side of it, to be honest with you. At the moment, you have to buy the whole Google suite of apps or none at all. So if you want to give people the Gmail app, then you have to also take Google Maps and a bunch of the other stuff that goes in.
Well, so it's either G Suite or no G Suite, right? You either sign in or you don't.
Exactly, which means it's really hard. If you are a maps company who are not Google Maps, it's hard to get any play anywhere.
Right.
Because no one is prepared to take you and therefore drop all the other Google suite of apps. You know?
Search aside, I can see something coming where they have to unbundle the suite and not say that you have to either ship none of their things or all of their things.
Yeah, and that's why I think this kind of thing is interesting. It's stopping people who are dominant in one area from using that to dominate other areas, which is exactly what the Department of Justice thing is about. Is exactly what this is about.
But is there, the other thing though is, from an intellectual perspective, I get that, you know, this notion of not bundling in all of Google's apps, right, and giving people choice. But I have an Android phone. I have the most googly of Google Android phones. I have a Google Pixel, right? It comes with all that crap installed. But there is loads of non-Google stuff that I just install afterwards that I can use. Like, I mean, people still have the chance to get that stuff. I mean, it depends on you using the Google Play Store, which is a separate question. But surely, even if you get all that stuff installed, like I've got all kinds of
Google
stuff. Well,
to ship
the Google
Play Store, though, you have to have signed the agreement, which allows you to ship all the apps. You can't not sign that agreement and ship the store on a phone.
Right. So that's why I don't understand this. On one hand, like, does this really impact consumers? I don't know if there's that many consumers who get a Google phone and are like, oh, I'm only going to use the things that are installed here and I'm not even going to load anything else. And if they choose to not load anything else, then that's their choice.
Hang on. You're arguing that the default choice of applications isn't important.
No, I'm saying it is important. What I'm saying is I wonder where, it's not like people aren't allowed to go and get other apps and install them, is my point. Right, you can go to the Google Store and get any number of other different
sets
of things.
Did you feel the same way when on Windows you could install other things and it was Microsoft?
Frankly, yes. I back then I was of the viewpoint, screw it, I can go and get other stuff. Although the difference there, I think, is there is a question then around, because your only access to the internet back in those primitive days was the browser that came with your operating system. It's easier now, and people are more aware now that there are options online. I think back then it was a little different because you really depended on the bundled software that came with your computer, because it was less of an online society back then. So I have more sympathy towards the argument back then. But these days it's like everybody knows. If you're going to get a smartphone, you know what app stores are. You know, you can, people, there's such a culture around applications now. I just wonder how many people are really affected by this, is my point. Anyway. Okay. Anyway, I'm tired of being right. I'm tired of being right.
It sounds like this could easily turn into a segment because we have three pretty diverging opinions on this one, it sounds like.
Yeah. We will do this.
We will do this segment. Meanwhile, I'm Mr. Bookmark. Tired of being right. I don't even know how you know what the experience of being right is, but
you mean like Facebook VR? Like Facebook VR becoming real?
Oh, for God's sake, this guy.
You guys.
Chap called Bitten has just tweeted at the Bad Voltage account to point out that Facebook VR is in beta. Now, I admit, for the first time in his entire life, Jonathan Edward James Bacon predicted a thing and got it right, which is really annoying.
And it could not have been a more soul-crushing topic.
Given just the unbelievable levels of fucking smugness that you two demonstrated when I made that prediction, just how much you roundly mocked me. This is not just like, it might happen. Like, you guys bet the farm on this one, and you're wrong. And I don't get to say that very often. The other thing that I've been universally right about, by the way, is a proven design methodology of placing a bold word next to a non-bold word, okay? Netflix have adopted this, and they're using it very effectively, okay? Anyway, I have some news. Hang on, I've lost my browser. Let me just load it up so I can redo it. So a survey has found, rather unsurprisingly, 3 million motorists were surveyed, and 9 out of 10 people admitted to using their smartphones behind the wheel, right? And they, according to a report by Zendrive, which studied the device usage across 3.1 million drivers, over 5.6 billion miles of driving, in 88% of trips, drivers made at least some use of their phones. On average, they spent more than 3 minutes on their phones. Now, I haven't looked into the data specifically to determine whether that's being on the phone, like on a phone call, is, you know, if you've got a Bluetooth system in your phone and you're having a conversation, that's one thing, right? Or whether you're actually texting or sending emails or Snapchatting. Yeah, exactly. You know, sending dick pics to people, you know, seems like a bad thing to do behind the wheel. But this really, I find this really pretty deeply concerning because, I mean, there is no doubt that, you know, there is a pretty straight dotted line between accidents and people using their phones.
Right.
And it seems that the deterrence that, you know, these adverts and PSAs and all this kind of stuff isn't really having as much of an effect. And I'm curious to know, like, it strikes me that there is a technological solution to this problem in some ways. But I don't know what that's going to be. What do you guys think?
What technological solution?
Well,
are you just going to make phones not work where they're inside a car?
A couple apps have tried that in the past without thinking, like, hey, I could be a passenger. And then disabled it. But a couple apps did do that for a while. If you were going over like 30 miles an hour, they wouldn't work.
Yeah, Apple have actually patented some kind of technique which allows the police to remotely shut down phones.
Now, what could go wrong?
Whether they've actually deployed it into phones or whatever is not clear. But, I mean, presumably you could have those things and then bolt them into the side of motorways or whatever. But then, yeah, what if you're a passenger, right?
Well, I don't know. I just... But the one thing that...
I don't think there's a technological solution. It's like speeding, right? If you asked... In that same survey, they should have said, have you ever exceeded the speed limit? And the number, if anything, would have been higher. And there is also a very clear proven link between going too fast and having accidents. And well, everyone does that too, right?
Well, I'm just wondering whether there are, you and I have talked about this a bunch in the past. Yeah? That classic example in the Rory Sutherland presentation about the unhappy frowny face on the speeding sign.
Yes.
For those of you who haven't heard this story, Rory Sutherland, we've mentioned him before on the show, is a brilliant speaker and talks about behavioral economics. And one of the things he said is there was those LED speed signs in Scotland, and the Scots use those signs more of like a competition than a deterrent, where it showed the speed that you're going. And someone changed it to an unhappy frowny face, and the accident rate went down. Now, there's all kinds of caveats that relate to behavioral economics, but I just wonder whether there is a mixture of location, devices with all these different sensors on there, behavioral economics, psychology. I just wonder if there's some kind of combination of all those different elements that can have a more natural way of preventing this from happening. I don't know what it is, but But I just think that kind of stuff is interesting.
I think because the technologies are so new, as it's better integrated into cars, I think you will. So there was a little paradoxically, when they initially made texting illegal, accidents actually increased, because previous to that, people would kind of have their phone up by the dashboard looking at it. And in an effort to not get caught, instead of not texting, people kind of put their phones below their steering wheel and had to look down. So it actually was worse, because people were trying to hide the fact that they were texting. So I think as cars have this more integrated into them, and Android Auto and stuff take off, where you can just kind of naturally talk to the car to reply to a text and things like that, that would be one technological solution that I think actually would work, because it's a better experience, you know, and you're not asking people to stop.
The other thing that might be interesting.
I was just going to say, just on that point, because when we got this Cadillac and it's got Android Auto support, right? Mm-hmm. So I've been using it quite a lot and it's quite good. But one of the things that is interesting on that note is when you plug it in, your phone can't really be used while Android Auto's on, apart from if you get notifications. If you get a notification, let's say a tweet notification, a DM, and you tap that, then it'll take you to the Twitter app. So there's a way around it. But one of the things that I've found is that when it's plugged in, I find that annoying. So I do tend to work around it. I'm just curious, you know, I'm just curious what's going to happen here. So
I think making it be uncool to do is, I think, the long-term solution. In the same way that people of our generation, and certainly the generation below us, don't drink drive anywhere near as much. Not because there's not the campaign, but because it's seen as not the good thing to do. Your friends will tell you don't do that, rather than everyone sort of nodding and winking at it. People are like, don't do that. Why would you do that? It's become a thing where people think you're weird for doing it. And I wonder whether, I mean, this might happen as part of the huge backlash against being permanently online social stuff, which is presumably coming at some point before the ants take over in 10 years or whatever.
But I don't know.
But that
I think Facebook VR will be the inflection point on that one, by the way.
There it is, right? Facebook VR. Given the fact that the new canticle for Leibovitz non-technical future.
I'm taking every ounce of effort right now to not start railing on millennials as the source of this problem. By the way.
So to sum that up, you think it's going to take a change in perception on the whole issue, Eck?
Yes, right. I do.
I think you're
It's not at all clear to me how finding a bunch of people whose problem is they can't afford houses or hold down a job and that's our fault and blaming them for this is fair, but nonetheless.
What?
Next topic.
Was that your defense of millennials?
It was. Next topic.
Millennials are shit. Anyway.
That was your attack, was it?
So onto the one news item that is about terrible IoT. And this is a little bit old, but it happened after we recorded last, so it's new in that context. And it's about, and I don't know why these companies have to have terrible names, but a Garagit? So it's an internet-connected garage door opener, and a customer purchased a device on Amazon, had a problem with it, specifically with the Android application that came with it, and he left an angry comment on the Garagit community board, and then shortly afterwards, the same day though, left an even angrier response and a one-star review on Amazon saying, "This thing is junk, don't waste your money, the Android app is a piece of junk, crashes constantly, the startup company that obviously has not performed proper quality assurance tests on their products." And almost immediately after that, the owner of the company posted this: "Martin, the abusive language here and in your negative Amazon review submitted minutes after experiencing a technical difficulty only demonstrates your poor impulse control. I'm happy to provide the technical support to the customers on my Saturday night, but I'm not going to tolerate any tantrums." So far you're thinking that's a pretty direct response, but not that bad. And here comes the pièce de résistance. At this time, your only option is to return Garagit to Amazon for a refund. Your unit number, which is 2F0036, has been disabled and will be denied server connection. So he remotely bricked the guy's device.
What?
Yeah.
Hang on. Presumably not only did he remotely brick the guy's device, but now the guy has his car in his garage and can't get it out until he apologizes.
And everyone has his unit ID, which is probably the way you control it. So Matthew Garrett's probably opening and closing his garage right now on top of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. As you connect to open.php ID equals that number on their website, and then boom, there it is. Oh, my God. He reached out and bricked the guy's...
For a negative Amazon review. So just when you thought IoT could not get any more ridiculous, there you go, garage it.
On one hand, I mean, that is just abhorrent that the guy did that. On the other hand, lol.
I'm glad I am neither of the
parties. It is quite amusing, but it's...
I'm glad I'm neither of the parties in this exchange, because now it becomes a little shining jewel of an example to show to people about why you shouldn't buy the egg cleaner or whatever the hell it is that you've seen with a Wi-Fi chip in it.
Right. Wow. That is awful.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, I think of the three of us, I see the most value in some IoT, but instances like this make it difficult to keep having that stance, I will say.
It's hard to justify that. How's your drop cam, Jono?
Shut up.
I wouldn't complain about it on Amazon if I was you. Otherwise, you get responses, hey, Jono, your drop cam has now been disabled. But before that, we took this picture of you with your nuts out and posted it on...
I honestly haven't had that much of a chance to check into the drop cam since we last talked about it, because I've been too busy hanging out in virtual reality Facebook.
You're such a liar, honestly. You didn't even know it was there.
Well, at least the drop cam can stream to the internet live, me being right about VR predictions constantly.
That's what technology's for. Right, thank you very much, everybody. It's the end of the news.
Now, normally in Bad Voltage, we kind of will have two or sometimes three segments, but I think there's a little bit of a special case this episode in that there were some pretty big Linux-related news recently, and I think we're going to take enough time here that probably with the news, this will be the only segment that we do. I'm going to go out on a limb on that one.
I think so.
And the news, of course, and we are a little bit probably behind other outlets on this one just because we record twice a week and it happened pretty early in that cycle. But it is that Canonical has announced that they're making a pretty big change in direction, and that change is coming along with some pretty big changes from a personnel perspective and from CEO perspective, et cetera, et cetera, as Mr. Bacon tries to distract me with moving bacon.
Sorry.
So in that, I mean, Ack, you worked there for a while. Jono, you worked there for a very long time and kind of were one of the outlets between the community and the company. So I was, you know, there's a lot to talk about here. And obviously it's a sensitive subject because, like I said, it did come with some personnel changes, and that's always something that, you know, is yeah. difficult. And there's honestly, as long ago as this was announced, a lot of the news and stuff hasn't even fully come out yet. So there's,
yes.
It's a sensitive subject in that regard, I understand. But I thought we would, I don't know what order you want to talk about it in or how you want to handle that, but there's quite a bit to talk about here from, you know, they changed direction on Unity and Mir, which some people were pretty surprised about, to, you know, Jane stepping down. So, A, what do you guys think overall? Yeah. And then we can kind of go through the topics maybe we should chat.
To make sure everybody who's listening is up to date on everything, maybe we should just blast out the information that we have.
Sure.
So Canonical made the decision to stop investing in the mobile side of things and the conversion vision. So Unity is no longer something that Canonical is building. Mir is, I believe, on life support because it's being used in some IoT-related areas. The desktop, the Ubuntu desktop is going to move over to GNOME.
Yep.
Or is it 18.04?
No specific dates for this have been set. Yes, 18.04 seems to be the target.
Right.
But a lot of this stuff, we're going to end up avoiding talking about dates and when things are going to happen, except as part of our opinions, just because none of it's known yet.
Right. Exactly. Mark has stepped in as the CEO role, and Jane Silber is maintaining a board seat, but will be leaving the company, I believe.
Yes.
What's been said is she's no longer going to be CEO, and she will have a seat on the board. The assumption from that is that she's leaving the company. Other than that.
No, she posted a blog post saying that
her blog post actually confirms that. Does it? She's
yeah.
She's going to stick around for a bit. Whatever it was.
It was certainly valedictory.
And then she said she's going to be looking for other opportunities.
Yeah.
A number of people have been let go because of this. I've seen contrasting views on how many people that is. I've heard people say that it's a third of the company. I've heard that that people say that it's like 70 odd people or 80 people. I don't know what the current number is.
Yeah,
but there's a bunch of people. There's a lot
of speculation and so on, but it's clearly happening. And I'm seeing certainly people who I know, people who I've worked with, and so on, posting saying, "Yes, I'm in the market for new jobs or whatever." So
right.
This is not some kind of theoretical.
Some people
thing.
Have publicly posted. Some people have not publicly posted.
Yes,
and I think part of it is because they're such a distributed company. Many countries have vastly different laws as how you handle these kind of things. So I think they're kind of working through that in one large chunk too, is part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yes. So,
all right. So what do we think? Why don't we start with you, Langridge? What do you think?
What do I think? My focus here is kind of the desktop, and that's not necessarily Canonical's focus. That being the point. I mean, so most of the thinking I've done around this has been how it's going to impact the desktop. There's how it's going to impact servers and cloud. But for my use of those things, it's basically not going to affect it at all. Ubuntu is pretty dominant in some areas, is a reasonable player in others. To the extent to which I spin up servers either in the cloud or on hardware, that's basically untouched by this change, as far as I can tell. Mark reaffirmed Canonical's commitment to building that. Great, I can still have a server in which I can SSH into it and app get things, and I can spin up cloud instances and whatever you, and that's what I need. I'm not a big style sysadmin for this.
Right. But there is a tangential link, because one piece of information we left out from the data dump of what's going on. There's been reporting. I don't know how accurate or how... I don't know. Yeah, but I don't know how accurate this is. But there's been reporting that part of the reason for these changes is because Canonical has been seeking outside investment. And the reason why some of these changes have been made has been that the investors have basically said, you need to kind of like tidy up shop.
And
focusing on the server side.
Half of that is known and half of it is speculation, as far as I can tell.
Right, exactly.
The thing about there being external investment was discussed by Mark in an interview. Exactly how much influence that discussion has had on these changes is the most outrageous speculatively...
Yes.
Most outrageous piece of speculation ever. It's all people sitting outside going, hmm. But I think you could, you know, it's reasonable to draw some conclusion about there being a connection here.
And multiple different options there are at least plausible. I don't think there's one that's, you know, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's some overridingly obvious thing that happened, whether that's whether they're heading for taking external investment, or whether they're heading for an acquisition, or pivoting or something like that. You know, it's hard to tell. Anyway. There's a bunch of plausible stories there. So,
but carry on. Sorry, I interrupted you.
To be honest with you, the major play, exactly as Canonical have said, is server and cloud stuff, right? And possibly IoT. That's where they're getting. That's where they certainly appear to be getting most of the revenue from. It's where most of the entrenched business is. To some extent, Ubuntu's one of the Ubuntu properties. One of the valuable things about it is the brand.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in the sense that when someone brings out a thing for Linux, they tend not to anymore. They bring it out for Ubuntu. Right. Which is true on both servers and the desktop ISVs, I think. If you go and get some piece of server software, whether open source or not open source, if they've got Linux instructions at all, certainly from a more kind of web, put it together yourself, get stuff from GitHub end of the world, it's all here are the Ubuntu instructions. From a big picture enterprise, plug this into your Oracle database stuff, it's all Red Hat.
Right.
But that's fine. Yeah. Right? I think those two things coexist quite neatly. Mm-hmm. Red Hat are good at going after the big enterprise market, and are a $2 billion company because of it.
So do you think that, given your love of the desktop, do you think that Canonical's made the right decision to invest? Stop investing as much in this stuff?
I think what the last few years have proved is that Canonical do not have the resources to entirely forge their own path on a consumer-focused thing. Attempting to build a phone from the ground up, or a complete desktop environment and everything that goes into it and so on, Canonical just don't have enough people and money to do that. And it didn't get everyone else to buy into that plan. So Canonical ended up doing it on their own. I mean, you could have all sorts of arguments about whether everyone didn't buy into it because Canonical wanted to do it on their own and own it and so on. But just completely leaving aside why that happened, I think it became clear that there are too many
Android
holes
to be usable,
in the thing.
Arguably, yeah. Google doesn't have the resources to do it on their own because it took them years and years and years, and they're Google.
As I have said before, what Canonical spend on the company, Google spend on Post-its. Right, and it took them a decade to get to the point where it was challenging. Apple are the richest company in the world, right? And it took them how long, right? And the Canonical dream always has been that, you know, small, but because you can do a kind of a narrow focus and you've got the weight of the community behind you, you can punch a lot higher than your weight, which may be the truth still, but I think this has proved that It's hard to do that if the community aren't behind you, and it's hard to do that even if they are, because the community are too busy fighting with one another.
To be fair, I think they have punched considerably above their weight, but there's punching above your weight, and then there's expecting a two-year-old to knock out Mike Tyson, and those aren't the same thing.
Well, the thing is, my view on this is somewhat complicated, because on one hand...
Yes, mine too.
So first of all, I think that they've made the right decision. I'm actually surprised it took this long. The mobile, I think we had a valiant effort at trying to build a compelling open source mobile platform. It didn't work out. And that's fine. I think, you know, as I wrote in a blog post about this, I think everyone who participated in this did it with good intentions and big hearts, and it just didn't work out. And it was always going to be a David and Goliath effort anyway.
Right. So a quick question to both of you. Do you think they didn't deliver on the convergence vision well enough, or do you think people don't want convergence, out of curiosity?
I certainly think people...
Both.
People don't want convergence at the moment. The jury is, in my opinion, out on whether people would want convergence if it were presented to them in a compelling way, which nobody has done. I feel about it the same way I feel about the privacy thing, right? I think people in general don't want it, but I think it's because it hasn't been explained right, because the people who are good at explaining, right, aren't born yet or something.
Okay. So back to what you're saying, John.
I think people have become so used to existing form factors. I just don't think it's solving a problem that people have already got. Like, I mean, if you're in an office, for example, you know, you carry your laptop in between meetings. You don't necessarily take a phone and dock it in a bunch of different things. That's a pain in the ass. So I'm not so convinced about the conversion thing as much as I used to be. But the thing is that, and I mentioned this a little bit, I was on, you know, you guys were on Brian Lunduk's show, a few weeks ago, and I was on it last week, and I was talking to him about this. One thing that I said to him was, it's important to remember the context around Ubuntu when it started moving in the direction towards Unity, because back then, there wasn't really any differentiation between distributions, right? You got a Linux distribution. It came with something like GNOME. It came with the underlying, you know, Debian or RPM infrastructure. And the only differentiator that Ubuntu really had was that we tended to ship stuff early. Like, we used to get all the hot new stuff in Ubuntu first. But then 2 or 3 months later, it would be in Fedora, it would be in Debian, or it would be wherever else. And I think from a pleasing the community perspective, that is a great model. But if you want to make money, if you need to recoup your investment, you need to be able to differentiate in a way where people can give you money. And arguably, people can either A, go and get the thing that you're building for free anyway. And one of the things that Mark put in place from day one was the Ubuntu promise, which was Ubuntu will always be free. There'll never be a separate community edition, blah, 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 blah. And people give him a lot of shit about Ubuntu, but I think it's admirable that he stuck to his promise there.
Absolutely,
right?
There is stuck still to that, yes.
Do you think we will end up seeing kind of a RHEL model where it's going to be around support and services, not a different version of Ubuntu, but where you can...
I'd be surprised.
That would be a radical divergence from Mark's vision. I think if that happens, it will be... If that does happen, it will be a sign that whoever's calling the shots on that kind of thing is some kind of external investor person who wants to see ROI, and it isn't Mark anymore.
I think, much as I think he's burnt out on elements of the community, I think he still sees the importance of open source in that context.
And yeah, so on that note, that's one thing we kind of didn't list in that list, you know, as you went through the list of things involved here, was that his Mark stuck a boot in the community pretty aggressively.
We should get to that.
Well, we're going to get to that, but that's not what Canonical did. That's part of the discussion.
But the other thing as well, I think here is, you know, so Canonical started differentiating with Unity, and I think there was a genuine desire for that to be done within the GNOME project and all the rest of it, and I think that, you know, we're all familiar with all of the shit that went down around Unity and all the rest of it. I don't think we need to necessarily dig too much of that up. But my personal viewpoint in this is I think everybody acted in a suboptimal way. I think the GNOME project were probably a little too worried about, you know, about the impact of something like Unity on the project, a little too over-worried. And Canonical didn't engage in the community process as much as it should have done.
Well, so here is the thing. Canonical and GNOME are hopefully cooperating in the future. And the thing which will be absolutely poisonous to that is people relitigating what happened last time.
Exactly. Yeah. The thing is that and it's funny. I've actually, you know, I was chatting to some of the guys, like, you know, Endless, one of my clients, and you know, Cosimo is the executive director at the GNOME Foundation, and there's a bunch of people who work there. And I think people kind of, I'm not speaking for them, but we've talked about this quite a bit. And I think there is a general consensus that, like, that was just a complicated time back then. And there's no single right and wrong here. But in my mind, there is no doubt that the what happened with Unity and with Mir, because it couldn't canvas that community support behind it, it meant that Canonical were always going to be the primary investors in that stuff. And without a business model attached to it, it was never going to succeed. So, because there's only, Mark's a rich guy, but he's only got so much money.
Yeah.
This stuff. So I think with the best of intentions, it, that should have been shut down a while back.
I think the bind that they were in, to some extent, I think, is exactly as you said. If you want people to give you money for it, you need to differentiate. What you're saying is their differentiated thing didn't work, you know, but they didn't have the resources to do that. But that means you have to just say, fine, we're just not going to make money on this then. And no one wants, you know, the option of do this well and make money at it seems to not be on the table, which is sad.
The thing that's interesting on that note to me is if you look at the history of Canonical projects, the one thing that's consistent is a desire to build ecosystems.
Yes.
Right? So what happened is back in the early days when Ubuntu first came out, just because Ubuntu was frankly the best distribution at the time, this huge ecosystem, you know, was built around it, and we had the Ubuntu community, right? But there was a desire to build an ecosystem around Launchpad and a desire to build an ecosystem around Ubuntu Phone and around Mir and now around Snappy.
Because clearly the thing to do is not, if you want huge success, is to not build a thing. It's to build a platform on which other people build things.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And yeah, exactly. And it's like, to me, when you're looking at the building an ecosystem, so Snappy to me, I think there's opportunity there, right? Because it's actually solving a problem that a lot of people are having. The problem with the phone was, as we've already covered on the show, you know, with Christina Warren, when we talked about a viable third party, you know, it's really hard to compete with Google and Apple in that sphere.
Yeah, I mean, that's solving a problem that people have got, but it's a really hard problem to solve.
Yeah, right. With two gurus in the room.
Yeah, exactly. So, the whole chasing after a problem that people don't have thing is not the thing. That people do have a problem with the fact that they have to go to one of these two majority players for phones and that's it. But everyone who has tried has foundered on that lighthouse really, really terribly.
Right. I mean, I think the one thing in the mobile space that's clear is it's not even almost endless money still doesn't matter, because you look how much money Microsoft dumped into mobile and the market share that massive amount of money got them was...
And they literally dumped money into it. I mean, they found money.
Because everyone says,
oh,
well, you need apps. So they paid people to port apps, and they did all the things you think would have helped a little bit, and they got what maybe 1% at the peak, and less than 1% of the mind share. So.
Yeah, exactly, and that's precisely the thing. So competing on that ground, they've tried and failed, and they founded in a place where larger companies also failed. I mean, look at the list of people who've died on this particular hill. Right, the only people making money at this are Apple, Google, and Samsung. Every other, it's not even as if you can say, okay, people building a third-party mobile platform, a third mobile platform, have all died. You look at Palm, and look at Samsung building Baidu, and look at Badu rather, and look at Selfish and Ubuntu and Microsoft and whoever. Right. Everyone making Android phones is losing money hand over fist, apart from Samsung, for God's sake, right? This dragon has eaten bigger companies than Canonical. Where are Palm?
Right.
Yeah.
So
moving back to your desktop, do you think this is going to, let's say, medium term, they're going to de-emphasize the desktop, or you think this will actually end up with more resources going towards the desktop?
Well, the issue that I have here is I wrote a little blog post about, because I run GNOME Shell, since essentially work on Unity 7 stopped a couple of years ago. All the developers also going to Unity 8, which I do not run on the desktop and didn't really have any intention of running on the desktop. So I moved to GNOME Shell because that's where development was going on.
Finally, after months of wittering, by the way.
Yes, after months of wittering by Comrade Bacon, I agree with that. But
are you using Atom now?
So am I the only one of the three of us that uses Unity?
Unity, yeah.
I don't use Unity anymore.
I use GNOME Shell. Jono's got a Mac. And use Unity. My point is that
how you always say that with such derision. It's like you know, punching a donkey in the face. It's like, it's a freaking computer, whatever. Anyway, carry on.
I like the way Unity works. Mm-hmm. I like the layout of Unity. I like having the top bar and the indicators in the top right and buttons in the top left. And I like having the launch down the side. And I like having little tick marks next to things on the launcher, so I can see how many windows they've got. And I like having the quick menus in the launcher and so on. So I'm currently sat in front of an old laptop. So it's running Ubuntu Mate. But it's running Ubuntu Mate with the Mutiny extensions, which means it looks like Unity. And my GNOME Shell setup. It's got a launcher bar down the left hand side with all the marks on it, and it's got the icons in the top right, and I can roll the mouse wheel on the volume indicator. So I wrote a little blog post about this, right?
You know what's ironic, by the way? Can I just make a tiny point? All of the things that you've just identified are basically features in Mac OS X.
Yes.
All the things you like in Unity that you just identified that differentiate from GNOME are basically Mac OS X features.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. And the day and the day they decide to sell me an open source version that runs on hardware I choose, I will happily buy it because I like it.
Yeah, that's just an observation.
To quote to quote the one, the only George Castro, the problem with it is that it's not a free desktop. Right,
but it came free with my computer. Anyway, right. Just kidding.
I'm sure it did. I like the way Unity works, and I like the fact that it's possible to turn GNOME Shell into it. But it seems like you're not turning GNOME Shell into it, but you can make it feel that way. And I thought maybe Canonical were going to do that, but I don't think they are. Mark said pretty clearly that what he wants to do is ship a vanilla upstream GNOME experience. Right? He says, we will invest in Ubuntu GNOME with the intent of delivering a fantastic all GNOME desktop. We're helping the Ubuntu GNOME team, not creating something different or competitive with that effort. While I'm passionate about the design ideas in Unity and hope GNOME may be more open to them now, I think we should respect the GNOME design leadership by delivering GNOME the way GNOME wants it delivered. Our role in that, as usual, will be to make sure that upgrades, integration, security, performance, and the full experience are fantastic. It's just that if you're delivering what upstream want, then you're just basically Fedora. I don't understand how you can differentiate at that point.
But that's the point, I think. And that's why I think your question, Jeremy, about, you know, investment in the desktop at Canonical and things like that, to me, that perspective from Mark in itself speaks legions.
Yes.
What it says is, and I might be extrapolating too much here, is yeah, fuck it. Let's just ship whatever GNOME we've got. And let's not invest too much in the desktop team. Let's ship a desktop that works well. You know, it's going back to the Ubuntu of old. Like, ship what upstream we've got, theme it a little bit so it looks distinctive. But, you know, the upstream can take care of support, can take care of updates. You reduce the delta between what Ubuntu's got and what upstream have got, and people will use it because that's what, you know, Linux enthusiasts and people who care about the desktop, that's what they want.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, but yes, it's Ubuntu 8.04.
Right, but what it does is it sends a very clear message that there'll probably be a very small desktop team at Canonical that's maintaining this kind of stuff. But it's been maintained primarily for the community's benefit.
Which to me means long-term, from a vision perspective, the desktop does not come into the plan he has for Canonical.
Yes.
That would be my extrapolation.
Which worries me for the desktop Linux, which I use on all of my machines, because I don't think, I know that companies like Elementary, as an example, do not have the engineering resources to continue without basing on Ubuntu.
Yeah.
They're not going to add drive. They're not going to do a lot of the things that traditionally Canonical did. So they're rebase on another operating system, or I don't know what.
Yeah. What's interesting to me about this case is, to me, there's a good thing and a bad thing wrapped up in this. The bad thing, and you guys may disagree with me on this, but I think that this Canonical deciding to move away from investing in a differentiated Linux desktop is demonstrating that if you're a company and you want to make money from the Linux desktop in a way that is differentiated, so like it's not like you're shipping hardware, like System 76, they ship hardware, you buy hardware, right?
Yes.
You can't make money from it. Like, Canonical's proven that the model doesn't work. You know, the idea that you build something that everybody wants and then companies, you know, people install it and they buy support contracts and whatever else. Canonical has made it clear to me that that doesn't work. Red Hat had a crack at it. It didn't work.
Yeah. I would certainly say, I mean, there were people out there now going, no, it's just Canonical did it wrong for the following list of 50 reasons. But I am certainly much less convinced that it can work than I was 10 years ago. And I think someone claiming it doesn't work because they did it wrong, you should listen to my 20-point plan on how to do it right, has to fight a lot harder to justify that plan than they would have done 10 years ago.
Microsoft is not going to be forged by retracing the path that Microsoft took. There's no way.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the thing is, I would argue as well that because Canonical could not differentiate shipping purely upstream pieces, and Red Hat could not differentiate shipping purely upstream pieces, that you also cannot build a sustainable business by shipping an upstream centric open source desktop. So if you ship a desktop that's based on Debian, that's shipping GNOME or KDE or Elementary or whatever, I don't believe you can build a business around that. You have to build a business around either hardware or services. And even the services piece. Now, arguably, you could say that Canonical screwed up Ubuntu One, which is fair and unfair at the same time. But but to me, what this tells is that the Linux desktop is not a viable place to generate money. I just don't think I don't think it's going to happen. This is the year of the Linux desktop that we joke about every year, to me, is no longer good. There is no semblance of that happening. But the good thing, I'd say, the good thing of this, the silver lining, is that the Linux desktop, as we've talked about in a previous show, it's designed for the kind of people who are interested in Linux. It's designed for Linux and open source fans. Mm-hmm. And now there's unity around that, no pun intended, around everyone's going to be using Wayland, everyone's going to be using GNOME Shell or KDE or whatever else. And now I think there'll be all that complexity will be gone. And I think that what we'll actually end up getting is a better Linux desktop because of it. So
I certainly think we'll get... It'll be better at doing the things that it currently does. What I wanted to see was it take a leap into a slightly larger group of people, because then I get things like a really decent photo editor.
Right? Yeah, like I think the dream was always like it's. But people who use Macs will use the desktop, right? And or people who use Windows use the desktop. I don't think that's going to happen.
There would be an ecosystem. Something yep. which something where you're fine if you can't sell the desktop, no problem. But someone can sell me an alternative to Audacity, right?
Right.
But there just isn't the market for that.
Yeah, and it's that's sad. But on the other hand, it's cleansing as well.
It is the right thing to do. I mean, one of the things I've debated doing. Built on the back of, I sat down and sketched the little blog post out, and a bunch of people seemed to have responded to that in a kind of, hey, I'd like Unity. I'd like a Unity-ish experience. Now, there was a meeting today, a public meeting on IRC with some of the desktop team from Canonical and some external people. Jerry Bicker was there and a few others. It's all on irclogs.ubuntu.com, discussing exactly what the plan is. And it's still very early days, and no one's really sure exactly what the plan is. But it's a kind of, it seems to be very much what Mark's suggesting, that it's a pretty much vanilla GNOME desktop experience, at least at first. So what I'd like to see is someone, maybe that's me, comes up with a way of turning the Ubuntu GNOME desktop experience into something a bit more Unity-like, but without it being a fork. It's just basically, here is a list of extensions you can install, settings you can change, but none of it is install this alternative version of this core system library or something. It's not a, it's something, and to me, the bright line test for this, the way you prove that it's true is that you can do it on Fedora.
Right. Hence, Ubuntu is born.
Yes, Ubuntu is born. Exactly that.
Is it going to go back to being orange?
yeah, be orange again. That's what it'll be. But I think that would be a really good test. One of the points that was made today in the meeting is that this is potentially a chance to. Fine, it may annoy a lot of people if the Unity-ish experience goes away. But then this is a chance to do that. If you deliver someone a sort of it works a bit like Unity but not quite thing. And then try and take it away later. Everyone's like, why are you taking it away? Leave us with it. So maybe this is the, rip off the Band-Aid kind of thing. But I think that if you have a set of instructions or whatever for providing people a Unity-like experience, and you can deliver those on something that isn't Ubuntu, then to me, that's cooperating with upstream. That's exactly how it should be worked. You use their platform to build a new thing.
Devil's advocate question, isn't that what Elementary is?
No.
Elementary is not a million miles away from Unity.
No, the Elementary people would be alarmingly cross to find out that you think that their thing is just a bunch of GNOME shell extensions.
that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when you went through the things that you like about Unity, you basically described, as I mocked you with, you basically described the common features in Mac OS X. That's essentially what the Elementary people are building, right? So, they're building that experience.
So your question is, why wouldn't I just use Elementary rather than installing GNOME Shell and a bunch of extensions to make it look like Unity?
Right.
And that's a reasonable question. And as I said before, I just think their team's too small. You know, and why they don't have the resources to do even the stuff they've committed to, which is not that much. Although I am working on packaging stuff up for their thing and putting pick my color picker thing in their app center. I'd really like to do that when that becomes available, and that will give me a useful sense of how many people use these things, how difficult it is, whether they but. To me, Elementary have the same kind of mindset that Canonical did, that we know what we want and we want to deliver it, and we will use upstream technology to do that, but where upstream don't like what we're doing or don't agree with what we're doing or just aren't as advanced as us, we'll build our own thing instead. And I think it's a great idea. It's just I watched Canonical try it and fail.
Yeah.
And
there's all kinds of reasons why they've got,
and Daniel Fore, much as I like the bloke, one of the differences between him and Mark, you know, I mean, maybe you could talk about equivalence of vision, but what he doesn't have is $800 million. So
height.
one of the list of many, many things that he doesn't have is $800. But yeah.
Should we, speaking of which, should we talk about
about Elementary?
Jeremy mentioned Mark's comments on the community.
Oh, well, no, hang on. What we've heard here so far, before we get onto the comments on the community, which is a whole different topic, we've heard the Jono and the Stuart opinions on what Canonical should be doing. But as we've already established, the only one of us who actually runs the Unity desktop is Jeremy.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have the inside view. So.
Right. So yeah. Coming from a much different perspective, obviously, I think the one thing that disappoints me, maybe not exactly the right word, about Unity coming to an end here is that I agree with Stuart that I like the experience finally. Just recently, within the last few months, it finally stopped crashing regularly. So right when it finally works, they're pulling the rug out, as it were. So that is disappointing. And if there are a bunch of, if you go ahead with Stubuntu, I would use that, because a lot of these small polished things that it does, I do like, whether it came from OS X or not. My opinion on where they go or what they do, I part of me is concerned that whether, and I know this is obviously a little bit of a sensitive subject, but whether it is Mark really getting outside investment or whether it's Mark clearly being a little burned out of the community and saying, you know what, Canonical used to be my passion and I didn't care about burning the money because I have it. Now he's frustrated enough that it isn't, and it's a business now. And that means a whole different Canonical from top to bottom. And that concerns me a little bit, because I think Canonical, for many reasons, I know people who, it seems like a lot of people who don't or haven't worked for Canonical kind of like the shit on Canonical, but I think they're a good counterbalance and one that I think the Linux ecosystem desperately needs. And them going away, or them turning into a traditional company, which seems to be on the table, I think we're all worse for the wear for. And so that definitely concerns me.
Yep.
That's a good way of putting it. Yes. I mean, what part of the reason Canonical could do things differently is because they weren't a traditional company. Yes, there were some windmills tilted at, but it also meant that you didn't have to go, well, that's obviously not making money, so it just doesn't happen, and we'll concentrate on the boring things that make money. Right. And if that change is happening, the idea that, I mean, you want that kind of lovely attention to detail that at least some of the Unity stuff had, and it all had in theory, but in practice there wasn't the resources to implement most of it. You look at MPT specs for stuff, for almost anything. Someone will file a bug and they'll say, why doesn't it do this? And MPT will be like, it says it should do that in the spec, which I wrote in 2008, but just no one's had time to implement it yet. And right. that happened all the time. Now, it's possible that having lots more people collaborate will help on that, but I can't see Canonical getting excited about implementing things that the GNOME design team decided for them to do.
Right.
And if they start defining their own things, then it's not really cooperating with GNOME anymore, because then you get back to the same thing you had before, which is you've got competition in design views on how you think it should work, which is exactly the same as the Elementary team. You think that what they want is to work differently than GNOME Shell, work differently than Unity, and not have the resources to implement it by yourself, and everyone else won't cooperate.
And this is the challenging thing to me, is that this is what, again, like mentioned earlier on, like this is where everyone was right and everyone was wrong, you know, like, so, you know, that your point, Jeremy, kind of segues a little bit into what Mark, he posted a G+ comment. I don't have it in front of me, so I'm not going to recite it, but he basically clearly vented his frustration towards the attitude of some members of the community throughout the whole Unity experience. And I mean, he said at the end, the one thing I do remember him saying at the end of it was, fuck this shit. You know, and to be fair to him, some members of the community were just fucking horrible. It was borderline YouTube comment level of shit. And I sympathize with some elements of his view, with the fact that there were some members of the community who were not constructive, who were not trying to find a common ground and a common approach. They were just outright, this is not the way I like it, so therefore I'm going to do everything I can to stop it happening. It's like Washington, D.C., you know, partisan bullshit. And And yes. I have some sympathy towards that. But then again, on the other hand, where I do have some sympathy was you can look at that angle from another way of Mark was trying to ram his vision down a bunch of other people's throats and not doing it in a very particularly collaborative way. And so everyone was right, everyone was wrong.
There is some truth in both of those things, yeah.
Right.
I really hope that people can get past the idea of just relitigating that previous fight. Because if it's like, okay, so we want cooperation now between those things. If one of the sides is like, well, yeah, happy to cooperate, as soon as they admit they were wrong and come groveling back and going, okay, right. Then... I hope it doesn't happen like that.
And there's clearly still going to be some wounds on all sides of it. I mean, his post made it very clear that he's got some wounds.
He's not over it yet. No.
And I would go so far as to say that based upon my observation of what went down, I think it killed his enthusiasm in a bunch of community stuff.
Yeah.
And I understand why. I mean, this guy, looking at just from his perspective, he put in hundreds of millions of dollars of his own money into building free software, and some people treated him like Satan.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just, in every level of human decency, that's the wrong thing to do.
Totally.
Irrespective of whether...
And you can see him thinking, you see my role in the ecosystem to be, to put up a bunch of money, and then you decide what it gets spent on.
Right.
Right.
This is not how money works as it's currently designed, right?
Yeah, and, you know, so, yeah, again, like you say, not dragging everything up, but again, everyone was right, everyone was wrong. And I hope moving forward, people say, I'd like everybody to be able to say, you know what? Yeah, we all made some mistakes. You know what? Because that's the way in which we move forward, is that we accept that, fuck, we all screwed up in a way. I certainly did in my involvement. So...
We can relitigate those bits specifically.
It seems to get lost sometimes. Is that the yeah? Let's do that. We should make that an entire segment next show. Actually,
blamejono.com. We should do that. In fact,
we'll have Popey on as a guest presenter.
I think the thing that sometimes got forgot was that the more free and open source software that's in the ecosystem, the better off we are. Even if you don't agree with the decisions that went into it. Especially that he was pouring his own resources into it. The amount of vitriol sometimes aimed at him was surprising, even to me as someone on the outside. So I'm certain it was even more surprising on the inside. The other thing I'm curious on your opinions on, because you were both there during some of this time period, is kind of going back to earlier, Ak, you said that it was expected that they punch above their weight because they were smaller and nimble and passionate, et cetera, et cetera. Thinking about it now, the amount of times they did punch above their weight, were way ahead of the curve on something, and then utterly failed to monetize it is actually astonishing, because you look at Juju was way ahead of the Docker Kubernetes orchestration thing. Yep. Launchpad was before GitHub. And now that I think about it, I could probably think of five of those situations that are now massive ecosystems that they were either first or very close to first or the most polished early, and they did nothing with any of them.
Yeah. I can tell you what I think, and I think Langridge will agree with me on this one. I think there are two reasons why this is, and I'm just going to be unvarnished for a second. One is that Canonical spreads itself way too thin on all across a bunch of different areas. You know, at one time there was, you know, Juju and Ubuntu for phones, Ubuntu for desktops, Ubuntu for TVs, you know, all these different things. And with the best will in the world, you need...
And a lot of that, yes. You can look back on it with hindsight and say, wow, you see, Canonical got into that really early, before everyone else did. Mark basically spotted this trend, created this trend sometimes, but certainly spotted this idea before almost anyone else did, and built the first 10% of the product... But everyone else didn't fully grasp the vision, didn't get on board. And so they didn't go beyond the first 10% of the product because they didn't have the resources. You need someone to come in who's convinced by that 10% enough to get on board, to invest, to partner, whatever.
Right.
And then you could build the rest. And that didn't happen. You know, you build Launchpad and you look back on it now and say, well, that could have been GitHub 10 years earlier. But people didn't grasp what it could be. I think if you asked Mark... what was your vision for Launchpad? I mean, even ignoring the whole rose tinted glasses thing, I think you'd say what GitHub is now? Yeah, kind of that, except it would do twice as much stuff.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand that. I don't think anyone understood what GitHub is now. I don't think anyone saw that. But Mark did.
So he's good at having a vision, but not at productizing that vision and clearly articulating the benefits of the vision.
Yeah. Right, and I would argue that this leads to the second. So one is resources being spread too thin, right? Is not enough focus on, okay, we can't do everything, we're going to do these things. But then the second piece is, and much as I have unbridled amount of respect for Mark, he was part of the problem.
Yeah.
Is that what he would do is he would be leading a project and he'd be pushing the vision. But I don't think he had a team wrapped around him that can manage a founder like that. Like, as we know with startups, I mean, I see this all the time as a consultant, is there's these patterns in startups where you have a founder who's got loads of big vision, but their strength is not putting together the strategic delivery of that. They need people wrapped around them to do that.
Yes.
And I think the part of the problem is that Mark is such a force of personality that leads to that kind of vision and that kind of leadership, which can catalyze, you know, community members from around the world to get behind something. But the downside of that as well is that if you don't have those people wrapped around you, then that person can distract people away from the hard parts of delivering a product, which is not building the first iteration to Axe Point. It's the marketing plan and the sales cycle and building out the partnership relationships and things like that. And I think Mark's got a lot better at that over the years, and he's wrapped himself with more people around him who do that. But I think in those earlier days, that just didn't exist as a muscle in the company as much.
I think he gets very frustrated with the fact that other people can't see the vision and therefore do it wrong. So you go away and build something and then come back and you can see him thinking, but that's not what it should be like. Why are you so useless? And you're like, but we don't get it. And then afterwards you go, oh, I get it. Right, okay.
Right. and to be fair to Mark, Canonical...
It makes it very difficult to work for, but it must be very frustrating to be him. And right. I watch people take your brilliant idea and just piss on it the whole time.
And to be fair to Mark, and to be fair to Canonical, I think there are relatively few people who provide that intermediary function, who can interpret a founder's requirements and translate that into strategy. I think there are very few people who do that very well.
Right.
One person who did that, I think, really well at Canonic was Rick Spencer.
Well, you know,
here
is a question. Rick did do a reasonable job of that. To some extent, if you ask people who should be doing that, would it not be Jane? I mean, maybe Mark needs this whole kind of John the Baptist person who goes around ahead of him and interprets and explains things, right?
I would argue that it's the product leads of these things. Like, I would expect Jane to put together a strategy. Yeah.
Right. No. It's not traditionally a CEO's role. I agree with you. But Canonical is not a traditional company in the way it's set up.
Yeah, it isn't.
Right. I'm loath to point to people's job titles and go, but that's not their job, because no one had a title. And to some extent, it felt like Jane could do that, or could have been the person who did that. Because she wasn't, at least in theory, she wasn't subordinate in the way that, say, Rick was.
The challenge, though,
kind of managing the manager thing is...
The challenge, though, I think, is that part of the difficulty with Canonical is that, on one hand, while Mark, as the primary source of funding, was brilliant, because Mark could just get excited about something and pump in...
And just like, go, da-da, we're doing that. Yeah, now here it is. Like, decision changed.
I think I've shared this on the show before, but I'll never forget going out to Budapest. And I arrived on a Sunday flying out from California, and Mark was in the bar, and he came up to me, and he had, like, it looked like he'd just woken up on Christmas morning. He said, you know what we're going to do, John? I was like, what? He said, we're going to build a fucking mobile operating system. He said, Jane's in, we're in, we're going to do this. It's going to be incredible. We're going to get Ubuntu running on everything. And he was so excited about it. And the thing is that I think when you have that single source of funding, a primary source of funding, it's harder for the company to make really difficult kind of financial decisions. Like, a typical CEO will come in and they'll have to conserve cash and they'll have to make hard choices about things to cut. Whereas if the guy who's running the company could afford to build all of these things, then you don't have to make those hard cuts. But I think, so that's like the double-edged sword. On one hand, it's brilliant because you get to work on really cool things like Unity and whatever else. But on the other hand, from a business perspective, it doesn't have that discipline. And I think that's why this recent change has been good, because it's like that discipline's seemingly coming in.
But yeah, having the discipline is a good idea, but this is back to the point that Jeremy made earlier. They become like a sensible company now who are going to say, well, there basically isn't any money. We agree with the Bad Voltage team. There basically is no way to make money off the desktop. So they'll stop investing in the desktop. And then I've got to just sit back and hope that the Red Hat people decide to invest in Fedora enough that that trickles down to GNOME Shell and ends up working the way I want.
Right. So...
Or I move to elementary.
Well, you know what? We've been talking about this for nearly 50 minutes.
We have.
Should we shut up? Also, I'm hungry.
It is pretty important topic, dude.
It is. I don't believe the talking will stop.
I think it's one of those topics that we could talk for another 50 minutes and still have much more to say, so...
Oh my God, there should no
be I would guess there'll be future segments on bits of this, you know, as more comes out and as the landscape becomes more clear.
As we see lots more things unfold, yes. Right. I would like to say to people who don't have a job, I hope you find something. There seems to be quite a little cottage industry and people popping up and going, hey, you used to be at Canonical? I'm hiring. Which is really nice, you know.
Yeah, there's an ex-Canonical members Google Plus community and it's been really...
You're not supposed to talk about that. I know I'm ex-Canonical. That's secret.
And it's been nice. It's been nice seeing...
It really has been nice.
The response, like, you know, because everybody, you know, given all the shit that went down, the one thing that's consistent, and I think Ak might agree with me on this, is everyone who I know who's worked at Canonical, who has always said, it was the best job I ever had.
The people were always pretty much great.
Yeah.
That's why I feel for the people who've been... Yeah. Who've been let go, who've been laid off or fired or however it's worked out, because the project they were working on has gone away and they're kind of, oh, now what will I do? And a lot of them are my friends, you know? But because they're all smart people, I think they'll be able to find somewhere else.
And this probably seems like a good time to share. I haven't told you guys this yet, but I'm actually going to be rejoining Canonical on the executive team.
Well, I'll have fun with that.
I'm not really.
I'm aware you're not really.
Congratulations. Yes.
Stilted silence with that. So. All right.
I'm like, I can't decide whether he thinks this concept is more of a joke than it actually is. I'm just like, well, no, and why?
All right. So, people, let us know what you think on the forum. As usual, lots of interesting discussion to be had.
There is lots more to discuss here. Yes.
Yes.
That's the show.
It is. That was the show. Thank you.
I think the longest segment we've ever done, actually. Yes. 50 minutes.
Yeah.
So
I think so.
And hope you made it to the end.
Well, as Jeremy said, we could talk about this for another 50 minutes and another 50 minutes beyond that. And no doubt we will talk about it in every pub we're in for the next year or 2 years years.
We could also talk about it in Facebook VR as well.
No. Maybe.
Oh, shut up.
No.
About Facebook VR. Interestingly, we didn't really talk too much about what's going to happen. We originally think about sort of, you know, the past, present and future of Canonical and Ubuntu. And we haven't speculated much on the future yet. And that's, you know, fodder for
a I do on the future. I know we talked about Canonical for a while, but I guess I do have a quick question for you two. Now, you both have predicted in the prediction show for the last few years that part or all of Canonical will be sold. How do you think this impacts that prediction of yours?
I think I'll probably be less of a smug twat about it when it turns out to be the truth than Jono is.
I don't know. I need to think about it some more.
It's been Fair. Confirmed, right? It's been all but confirmed that Canonical are taking on investment. Does that count as selling? Does that qualify for my prediction? Why?
Because, in what way, because someone words gives have you money meaning, in so we exchange can all communicate for ownership. And understand each other, and that word does not have that
Take
meaning.
Take an investment does not equate to selling. No. It's investment.
Yes.
It's not selling.
They have paid money in exchange for a thing. What do you think sales is?
They've paid money. Well, first of all, it depends on the nature of the agreement.
Bear with me. Right? I am assuming
they
pay buying
money for a share of the company. It's not a thing.
That's ownership.
That's not selling. Selling is selling a company wholesale to another company.
If you want to, get off. No, it isn't. If you wanted some if you wanted some shares, how would you acquire them? What would you do? Would you buy them, perhaps? Yeah, yes, you would. You would go and buy a share.
You would, but that's
your definition of selling here is not the definition that is agreed upon by everybody else that isn't you.
They come to you and give you some money in exchange for which you give them something. In this case, you give them ownership of a thing that you currently own. That's what sales is.
That's true. So the next time I go bowling and I rent a pair of shoes, I own the bowling alley. Is that right?
So you haven't bought it.
And neither have
you. You're renting it.
All right, next.
Oh, well, no. I'm utterly okay with the idea that investment is just renting a piece of the company. I think it might annoy every VC to find this out. But, you know, whatever.
When people use the term like being bought or sold to another company, it generally means wholesale, right? The whole thing, right?
Yeah.
It's not the idea. If the prediction, the question was, will Canonical entertain the notion of people investing in the company, buying shares in the company? That's a whole separate thing.
That says company X acquires company Y, you do not then read company X invested in company Y. It would never, ever happen that way.
Right.
No. On that point, I agree with it. But the whole point of the prediction was it's part or all of Canonical. It wasn't Canonical.
It was specifically worded as a division or all of.
Yes, it was either the cloud or the client division. Yes.
Right. Okay. No, that's fair then. I thought it was phrased as part or all. And to my mind, the client part and 30% of are just the same thing. But that's fair. If we said a division, then that's different. Yeah. And I would agree.
These recent revelations about my victory in one of the predictions is galling to you, but the fact that you're trying to adjust the rules or the recollection of that particular prediction just so you can share in the winnings too seems unfair.
If having Facebook release VR is what it takes to be right, I'd rather be wrong.
Yeah, I'll agree.
Anyway.
Spoken like a loser.
in that case, and the deafness of this segue will astound you, let us speak about a winner instead. Specifically, the winner of the Bad Voltage Fruit Competition. We did a live show, and we asked everyone to watch that live show, either by being present at the time or by watching the video afterwards, and list all the fruit that we came up with. And so Dell gave us a Dell Sputnik laptop, right? Really, really cool laptop, actually. And I've spoken to a bunch of people since who've played with one or bought one or whatever, and they're like, well, that laptop's great. And I've said, yeah, you can win one off of us. But the Ubuntu Podcast people did a review of it. It's a sweet laptop. So we had a competition.
Yeah.
Right, we named fruit, you listed fruit. We randomly chose a winner, and that winner's name is Kevin Williams. Right? So, Kevin Williams, we've contacted Kevin, and the laptop will be on the way. Your Sputnik will be winging its way to the post. Do let us know what you think of it, perhaps on the forums or something.
Yeah, congratulations, Kevin, and also everybody else. Yes. Now you know who to hate.
Exactly.
That guy, he won.
Apparently, Kevin used to jam with the Jacosha Project, he says.
He did.
I'm not saying that being a fan of me and Jono for a decade wins you stuff. I'm just saying.
But it does.
In related news, though, I should point out there was much fruit-related abuse submitted in this competition. I made the mistake of giving you all a big box of text to type in, so you were all downright unkind. Everyone seems terribly cross that Apple, the company, is also the name of a fruit, and therefore you had to name them. A lot of people point out that beans are fruits, that a kiwano and an African horned melon are the same thing.
I knew that.
Mm-hmm. You did not know that. I would also like it noted for the record that bacon is not a fruit, ginger is not a fruit, and pies are not fruits. Right? Admittedly, I get my five a day anyway, but that's not the point. A few of you said thank you very. Thank you. A few of you said thank you. And said nice things about the show, and we appreciate that. So,
yes.
Kevin Williams, laptop on its way to you. Meanwhile, as you may have noticed, some of the people who entered the competition entered from outside the US, and that wasn't allowed, for which I apologise. And what we're going to do about that is we are sending in... we are going to put the names of the people who entered from outside the US. We're taking those people, people who entered from outside the US, and we're putting your names into the next competition. So there's another competition coming up, and your names will go into that. Okay?
Right, right.
So we'll announce that competition in the next show, so keep an eye out for that. And people who are in the US, you won't be able to enter that one, ha-ha. But keep an ear out for that.
Yeah.
Good times. All right. I think we're done.
Yeah. Actually, I do have one update. Someone posted to the forum a few shows ago. I reviewed the Pico, and while I thought it was a cool device, it was a little on the expensive side, and they have released a new one that almost exactly hit my price point and is quite a bit smaller on top of it, as Toby42 pointed out in the forum. So thanks for pointing that out. They're doing a Kickstarter right now, and they also added a still, which is a way to produce liquor as a... stretch goal. So there you have it.
Nice.
Yeah. Thicky's question about that. Isn't that distilling moonshine, which is illegal?
So if you read how they word it, it is for distilling essential oils that could be made of hops or other related items. And if you have the correct tax setup, can also happen to make liquor.
Oh, if you're the clam pit, it's a still.
Right, so there's a...
most finely worded.
It is, because everyone, you know, people are clamoring to make those essential oils at home.
I love making essential oils in a moonshine.
Right, still. Exactly. But so exactly the laws around distilling in the US are actually changing pretty recently, especially in New York State. It's much, much, much easier to get a very small license. Before, basically, it was one license, so we either needed the giant license that was expensive and difficult to get approval for, or now they're doing smaller licenses. So if you want to get the license and sell it, good. If you want to illegally drink it at your house and brew it, they seem to be turning a blind eye, does the company. But yeah, it's the Pico C, they called it. Actually looks pretty cool, and at $300 is quite a bit more reasonable from a price perspective.
Excellent. I will buy one. I will change my name to Popcorn Bacon, grow a beard, and start making moonshine in Walnut Creek.
Nice.
Do it, right? The Hatfields and the McCoys. Big war in Walnut Creek.
All right. With that bombshell, let us end.